This old fellow didn't. He was going back to North Arkansas to starve where he had come from.
"California," he said. "It is just like the rest of the world, only it is more of it."
"Yeah," I replied, "that is a fact."
"You been there?"
he demanded. I told him I had been there.
"You going back home?"
he asked. I told him I was going home. We rode across Texas to Shreveport, Louisiana, where he left me to try for North Arkansas. I didn't ask him if he had learned the truth in California. His face had learned it anyway, and wore the final wisdom under the left eye. The face knew that the twitch was the live thing, was all. But having left that otherwise unremarkable man, it occurred to me, as I reflected upon the thing which made him remarkable, that if the twitch was all, what was it that could know that the twitch was all? Did the leg of the dead frog in the laboratory know that the twitch was all when you put the electric current through it? Did the man's face know about the twitch and how it was all? And if I was all twitch, how did the twitch, which was me, know that the twitch was all? Ah, I decided, that is the mystery. That is the secret knowledge. That's what you have to go to California to have a mystic vision to find out. That the twitch can know that the twitch is all. Then, having found that out, in the mystic vision, you feel clean and free. You're at one with the great twitch. So I kept on riding east, and after long enough, I was home. I got back late at night and went to bed. The next morning I turned up at the office, well-rested and well-shaved, and strolled in to say howdy-do to the boss. I had a great desire to see him, to observe him closely and find if there was anything in his makeup which I had previously missed. I had to look at him very closely, for he was the man who had everything now, and I had nothing. Or rather, I corrected myself, he had everything except the thing I had, the great thing, the secret. So I corrected myself, and in much the mood of a priest who looks down with benign pity on the sweat and striving, I entered the governor's office and walked past the receptionist and, with a perfunctory knock, into the inside. There he was, and he hadn't changed a bit. "Hello, Jack," he said, and swiped the forelock out of his eyes and swung his feet off the desk and came toward me, putting out his hand. "Where the hell you been, boy?" "Out west," I said with elaborate casualness, taking the proffered hand. "Just drove out west. I got sort of fed up around here, so I took me a little vacation." "Did you have a good time?"
"I had a wonderful time," I said.
"Fine,"
he said.
"How you been making out?" I asked.
"Fine," he said. "Everything's fine." And so I had come home to the place where everything was fine. Everything was fine, just the way it had been before I left, except that now I knew the secret. And my secret knowledge cut me off. If you have the secret, you can't really communicate anymore with somebody who hasn't got it, any more than you can really communicate with a bustling vitamin-cram brat who is busy with his building blocks or a tin drum. And you can't take somebody off to one side and tell him the secret. If you do that, then the fellow or female you're trying to tell the truth to thinks you're feeling sorry for yourself and asking for sympathy, when the real case is that you're not asking for sympathy but for congratulations. So I did my daily tasks and ate my daily bread and saw the old familiar faces and smiled benignly like a priest.
This ends Disc 13. All the King's Men, Disc 14.
It was June and hot. Every night, except those nights when I went to sit in an air-conditioned movie, I went to my room after dinner and stripped buck-naked and lay on the bed, with an electric fan burring and burrowing away into my brain, and read a book until the time when I would become aware that the sound of the city had sunk off to almost nothing but the single hoot of a taxi far off, or the single lost clang and grind of a streetcar, an owl car heading out. Then I would reach up and switch off the light and roll over and go to sleep with the fan still burring and burrowing. I did see Adam a few times in June.
He was more deeply involved than before in the work of the medical center, more grimly and icily driving himself. There was, of course, some let-up in the work at the university with the end of term, but whatever relief was there was more than made up for by an increase in his private practice and work at the clinic. He said he was glad to see me when I went to his apartment, and maybe he was, but he didn't have much to say, and as I sat there he would seem to be drawing deeper and deeper into himself, until I had the feeling that I was trying to talk to somebody down a well and had better holler if I wanted to be understood. The only time he perked up was one night, when, after he had remarked on the fact that he was to perform an operation the next morning, I asked about the case. "It was a case of catatonic schizophrenia," he said. "You mean he's a nut?" I asked. Adam grinned and allowed that that wasn't too far wrong. "I didn't know you cut on folks for being nutty," I said. "I thought you just humored them and gave them cold baths and let them make raffia baskets and got them to tell you their dreams." "No," he said, "you can cut on them." Then he added, almost apologetically, "a prefrontal lobectomy." "What's that?" "You remove a piece of the frontal lobe of the brain on each side," he said. I asked, "would the fella live?" He said you never could tell for sure, but if he did live, he'd be different. I asked, "how did he mean, different?" "Oh, a different personality," he replied. "Like after you get converted and baptized?" "That doesn't give you a different personality," he said. "When you get converted, you still have the same personality. You merely exercise it in terms of a different set of values."
"But this fella will have a different personality?"
"Yes," Adam said. "The way he is now, he simply sits on a chair or lies on his back on a bed and stares into space. His brow is creased and furrowed. Occasionally he utters a low moan or an exclamation. In some such cases, we discover the presence of delusions of persecution. But always the patient seems to be experiencing a numbing, grinding misery. But after we are through with him, he'll be different. He'll be relaxed and cheerful and friendly. He'll smooth his brow. He'll sleep well and eat well and will love to hang over the back fence and compliment the neighbors on their nasturtiums and cabbages. He'll be perfectly happy."
"If you can guarantee results like that," I said, "you ought to do a land office business as soon as the news gets round."
"You can't ever guarantee anything," Adam said.
"What happens if it doesn't come out according to Hoyle?"
"Well," he said, "there have been cases, not mine, thank God, where the patient didn't become cheerfully extroverted, but became completely and cheerfully amoral."
"You mean he would throw the nurses down right on the floor in broad daylight?"
"About that," Adam said, "if you'd let him. All the ordinary inhibitions disappeared."
"Well, if your guy tomorrow comes out like that, he'll certainly be an asset to society." Adam grinned sourly and said,
"He won't be any worse than a lot of other people who haven't been cut on."
"Can I see the cutting?" I asked. I felt all of a sudden that I had to see it. I'd never seen an operation. As a newspaper man, I had seen 3 hangings and 1 electrocution, but they're different. In a hanging, you don't change a man's personality. You just change the length of his neck and give him a quizzical expression. And in an electrocution, you just cook some bouncing meat in a wholesale lot. But this operation was going to be more radical even than what happened to Saul on the road to Damascus. So I asked, could I see the operation?
"Why?" Adam asked, studying my face. I told him it was plain curiosity. He said, "All right, but it wouldn't be pretty." "It would be as pretty as a hanging, I guess," I replied. Then he started to tell me about the case. He drew me pictures and he got down books. He perked up considerably and almost talked my ear off. He was so interesting that I forgot to ask him a question which had flitted through my mind earlier in our conversation. He had said that in the case of a religious conversion, the personality does not change, that it is merely exercised in terms of a different set of values. Well, I had meant to ask him how, if there was no change in personality, how did the person get a different set of values to exercise his personality in terms of? But it slipped my mind at the time. Anyway, I saw the operation. Adam got me rigged up so I could go right down in the pit with him. They brought in the patient and put him on the table.
He was a hook-nosed, sour-faced, gaunt individual who reminded me vaguely of Andrew Jackson or a backcountry evangelist, despite the white turban on his head made out of sterile towels. But that turban was pushed pretty far back at a jaunty angle, for the front part of his head was exposed. It had been shaved. They put the mask on him and knocked him out. Then Adam took a scalpel and cut a neat little cut across the top of his head and down at each temple, and then just peeled the skin off the bone in a neat flap forward. He did a job that would have made a Comanche brave look like a tyro with a scalping knife. Meanwhile, they were sopping up the blood, which was considerable. Then Adam settled down to the real business. He had a contraption like a brace and bit. With that, he drilled 5 or 6 holes, burr holes, they call them in the trade, on each side of the skull. Then he started to work with what he had told me earlier was a gilye saw, a thing which looked like a coarse wire. With that, he sawed on the bone till he had a flap loose on each side of the front of the head and could bend the flap down and get at the real mechanism inside. Or could as soon as he had cut the pale little membranes, which they call the meninges. By that time, it had been more than an hour. Or so it seemed to me, and my feet hurt. It was hot in there, too, but I didn't get upset, even with the blood. For one thing, the man there on the table didn't seem real. I forgot that he was a man at all and kept watching the high-grade carpenter work which was going on. I didn't pay much attention to the features of the process which did indicate that the thing on the table was a man. For instance, the nurse kept on taking blood pressure readings, and now and then she would mess with the transfusion apparatus. For they were giving the patient a transfusion all the time out of a bottle rigged up on a stand with a tube coming down. I did fine until they started the burning. For taking out the chunks of brain, they use an electric gadget, which is nothing but a little metal rod stuck in a handle with an electric cord coming out of the handle. The whole thing looks like an electric curling iron. In fact, all the way through, I was struck by the notion that all the expensive apparatus was so logical and simple and homey, and reminded me so completely of the stuff around any well-equipped household. By ransacking the kitchen and your wife's dressing table, you can get together in 5 minutes enough of a kit to set up in business for yourself. Well, in the process of electrocautery, this little rod does the trick of cutting, or rather burning. And there's some smoke and quite a lot of odor. At least it seemed like a lot to me. At first it wasn't so bad, but then I knew where I had smelled an odor like that before. It was the night long back when I was a kid, when the old livery stable had burned down at the landing and they hadn't managed to get all the horses out. The smell of the cooking horses was on the still, damp, ripe night air, and you couldn't forget it, even after you didn't hear any more of the shrieks the horses had made. As soon as I realized that the burning brain had a smell like the burning horses, I didn't feel good. But I stuck it out. It took a long time, hours more, for they can't cut but a little bit of brain at a time and have to keep working deeper and deeper. I stuck it out until Adam had sewed up the meninges and had pulled the skull flaps back into place and had drawn up the flap of skin and laced it down all ship-shape. Then the little pieces of brain which had been cut out were put away to think their little thoughts quietly somewhere among the garbage, and what was left inside the split-open skull of the gaunt individual was sealed back up and left to think up an entirely new personality. When Adam and I went out, and he was washing up and we were getting our white nightshirts off, I said to him, "Well, you forgot to baptize him."
"Baptize him?"
Adam asked, sliding out of the white nightshirt. "Yeah," I said, "for he's born again and not of woman. I baptize thee in the name of the big twitch, the little twitch, and the Holy Ghost, who no doubt is a twitch too."
"What the hell are you talking about?" he demanded.
"Nothing," I said. "I was just trying to be funny." Adam put on a faint, indulgent smile, but he didn't seem to think it was very funny. And looking back on it, I can't find it very funny myself. But I thought it was funny at the time. I thought it would bust a gut. But that summer, from the height of my Olympian wisdom, I seemed to find a great many things funny, which now do not appear quite as funny. After the operation, I didn't see anything of Adam for quite a while. He went out of town, up east, on business, on some of the hospital business, I supposed. Then, shortly after he got back, the thing happened, which just about left the boss in the position of having to hunt up a new director. What happened was simple and predictable. One night, Adam and Anne, who had had dinner together, mounted the stairs of the crummy apartment house to spy, on the landing before the door, a tall, thin, white-clad figure with a white Panama hat on its head, a cigar glowing in the shadow out of one side of the place where the mouth would be, and putting out an expensive aroma to compete with the cabbage. The fellow took the white hat off, tucked it lightly under an elbow, and asked if Adam was Dr. Stanton. Adam said he was. So the fellow said his name was Coffee. The name is Hubert Coffee, and asked if he could come in for a minute. Adam and Anne went in, and Adam asked the fellow what he wanted. He stood there in his white, well-pressed suit and two-color shoes, with no doubt intricate stitchings and ventilators in the leather, for I have found Hubert to be quite a dude. Two white suits a day, and white silk shorts with red monograms, they say, and red silk socks and trick shoes. And hummed and hawed out of his knobby, long, squash-yellow face, and coughed discreetly and significantly rolled his brown eyes, which are the color and texture of used motor oil, in the direction of Anne. Anne told me later, for she's my authority for the event, that she thought he was coming about being sick. So she excused herself and went back to the kitchen to put into the electric icebox a little carton of ice cream she'd picked up at the corner drugstore. She was planning on a quiet little evening with Adam, though her quiet little visits with Adam that summer must have been less than restful for her. She must have always had in the back of her mind the question about what would happen when Adam found out how she was spending some of her other evenings. Or was she able to lock off that part of her mind, the way you lock off some of the rooms of a big house, and just sit in the cozy, or perhaps not now so cozy, parlor? And sitting there, did she listen always for the creak of floor or the ceaseless tread of feet in the locked-off rooms upstairs? After she had put the ice cream away, she noticed that some dirty dishes were piled up in the sink. So to keep out from underfoot in the apartment while the men conferred, she set about washing the dishes. She'd about wound up the dishes when suddenly the incomprehensible drone of voices stopped. The sudden silence was what she noticed. Then there was a dry thump. That was the way she described it, and her brother's voice saying, "Get out." Then there was a sound of rapid motion and the slamming of the apartment door. She went into the living room to find Adam standing in the middle of the floor, very white in the face, nursing his right hand and his left across his stomach and staring at the door. When Anne came in, he turned his head slowly to her and said, "I hit him. I didn't mean to hit him. I never hit anybody before." He must have hit Hubert pretty hard, too, for his knuckle was split and swelling. Adam had a good weight of shoulder, even if he was slender. Anyway, he stood there nursing his split knuckle and wearing an expression of blank incredulity on his face. The incredulity, apparently, was at his own behavior. Anne, very much agitated, asked him what was the trouble. The trouble was, as I have suggested, simple and predictable. Gummy Larson had sent Hubert Coffee, who, on account of his white suits and silk monogram drawers, was supposed to have finesse and the gentlemanly approach, to try to persuade Dr. Stanton to use his influence to get the boss to throw the basic medical center contract to Larson. Adam didn't know all of this, for we can be quite sure that Hubert had not named the behind guy in the exploratory stages of the interview. But as soon as I heard the name Coffee, I knew that it was Larson. Hubert never got past the exploratory stages of the interview, but apparently he handled those stages rather broadly. At first, Adam didn't get what he was driving at, and Hubert must have decided that any of his high-priced subtlety would be wasted on this dumb cluck, and moved pretty directly to the point. He got as far as the idea that there would be some candy in it for Adam before he finally touched the button which set off the explosion. Still caught in the incredulity and nursing the numbed hand, Adam stood there and in a distant voice told Anne what had happened. Then, having finished, he leaned down to pick up, with the good left hand, the cigar stub which was slowly burning a hole in the old green carpet. He walked across the carpet, holding the stinking stub out at some length, and flung it into the fireplace, which still had in it, as I had noticed on my visits,
the ashes of the last fire of spring and bits of paper and orange peel from the summer. Then he walked back across the carpet and ground his foot on the smoldering place, probably with a kind of symbolic savagery. At least I could imagine that picture. He went to his desk, sat down, took out pen and paper, and began to write. When he had finished, he swung round to Anne and announced that he had just written his resignation. She didn't say anything, not a word. She knew, she told me, that there wasn't any use trying to argue with him, to point out to him that it wasn't the fault of Governor Stark, or the fault of the job that some crook had come and tried to bribe him. She knew from looking at his face that there wasn't any use in talking. In other words, he must have been in the grip of an instinctive withdrawal, which took the form of moral indignation and moral revulsion, but which, no doubt, was different from either, and more deep-seated than either, and finally, irrational. He got up from the chair and took a few strides about the room, apparently in great excitement. He seemed almost gay, Anne said, as though he were about to burst out laughing. He seemed happy that the whole thing had happened. Then he picked up the letter and stamped it. Anne was afraid that he would go out immediately to mail it, for he stood there in the middle of the floor, fingering it as though debating the issue. But he didn't go out. Instead, he propped it on the mantelpiece, took a few more turns about the apartment, then flung himself down on the piano bench and started to beat out the music. He sat there and beat it for more than 2 hours in a breathless July night, and the sweat ran down his face. Anne sat there, afraid, she told me, and not knowing what she was afraid of. When he got through and turned his sweat-streaked white face toward her, she fetched the ice cream and they had a jolly little family party. Then she went out and got into her car and drove home. She telephoned me. I met her at an all-night drugstore, and across the imitation marble top of the table in the booth, I saw her for the first time since the morning in May when she had stood at the door of her apartment and had read the question in my face and had slowly and wordlessly nodded the answer. When I heard her voice on the telephone that night, my heart took the little leap and kerplunk, like the frog into the lily pond, just as it had before, and for the moment what had happened might as well not have happened. But it had happened, and what I had now as my cab wheeled me downtown to the all-night drugstore was the wry and bilious satisfaction that I was being called on for some special reason the other fellow couldn't be expected to answer. But the satisfaction forgot even to be wry and bilious, and was, for the moment, just simple satisfaction when I stepped out of the cab and saw her standing inside the glass doors of the drugstore, a trim, erect figure in a light green polka-dot dress with some kind of a white jacket hung across one of her bare arms. I tried to make out the expression on her face, but before I could discover what it was, she spied me and smiled. It was a tentative, apologetic sort of smile, which said please and thank you, and at the same time expressed an innocent and absolute confidence that your better nature would triumph. I walked across the hot pavement toward that smile, and the green polka-dot figure which stood there behind the glass like something put in a showcase for you to admire but not touch. Then I laid my hand on the glass of the door and pushed, and left the street where the air was hot and sticky like a Turkish bath, and where the smell of gasoline fumes mixed with the brackish, dead-sweet smell of the river, which crept into the city on still nights in summer, and entered the bright, crisp, antiseptic, cool world behind the glass where the smile was, for there's nothing brighter, crisper, more antiseptic, and cooler than a really first-rate corner drugstore on a hot summer night. If Ann Stanton is inside the door, and the air conditioning is working. The smile was on me, and the eyes looked straight at me, and she put out her hand. I took it, thought how cool and small and firm it was, as though I were just discovering the fact, and heard her say, "It looks like I'm always calling you up, Jack." "Oh, that's okay," I said, and released the hand. It couldn't have been more than an instant we stood there then, without saying anything, but it seemed a long and painfully embarrassed time, as if neither of us knew what to say before she said, "Let's sit down." I started to move back toward the booths. Out of the tail of my eye, I noticed that she made a motion, quickly suppressed, to hang on to my arm. As I noticed that fact, the satisfaction, which had been for the moment simple satisfaction, was again merely the wry and bilious satisfaction with which I had started out. And it stayed that kind,
As I sat in the booth and looked at her face, which was not smiling now and was showing the tensions and the tightness of the skin over the fine bone, and showing, I suppose, the years that had gone by since the summer when we sat in the roadster, and she sang to Jackie Bird, and promised never to let anybody hurt poor Jackie Bird. Well, she'd kept her promise all right, for Jackie Bird had flown away that summer, before the fall came, to some place with a better climate where nobody would ever hurt him, and he had never come back. At least, I had never seen him since. Now she sat in the booth and told me, over our glasses of Coca-Cola, what had happened in Adam's apartment. "What do you want me to do?" I asked when she got through.
"You know," she said.
"You want me to make him stick to it?"
"Yes," she said.
"It'll be hard." She nodded. "It'll be hard," I said, "because he's acting perfectly crazy. The only thing I can prove to him is that if this coffee bastard tried to bribe him, it only indicates that the job is on the level, as long as Adam wants to keep it that way. It only indicates, furthermore, that somebody farther up the line had declined to take a bribe, too. It even indicates that Tiny Duffy is an honest man, or," I added, "hasn't been able to deliver the goods."
"You will try?" she asked.
"I'll try," I said, "but don't get your hopes up. I can only prove to Adam what he would already know if he hadn't gone crazy. He just has the high, cantankerous moral shrinks. He doesn't like to play with the rough boys. He's afraid they might dirty his Lord Fauntleroy's suit."
"That's not fair," she burst out.
I shrugged, then said, "Well, I'll try anyway."
"What will you do?"
"There's only one thing to do. I'll go to Governor Stark, get him to agree to arrest Coffey on the grounds of attempted bribery of an official. Adam is an official, you know. And call on Adam to swear to the charges. If he'll swear to them. That ought to make him see how things line up. That ought to show him the boss will protect him. And," to that point I'd only been thinking of the Adam men, but now my mind got to work on the possibilities of the situation, "it wouldn't do the boss any harm to hang a rap on Coffey. Particularly if he'll squeal on the behind guy. He might bust up Larson. And with Larson out, McMurphy wouldn't mean much. He might hang it on Coffey, too, if you..." And I stopped dead.
"If I what?" she demanded.
"Nothing," I said, and felt the way you do when you're driving merrily across the drawbridge and all at once the span starts up.
"What?"
she demanded. I looked into her level eyes and saw the way her jaw was set, and knew that I might as well say it. She'd work on me till she had it, so I said it. "If you will testify," I said.
"I'll do it,"
she said without hesitation. I shook my head. "No," I said.
"I'll do it."
"No, it won't wash."
"Why?"
"It just won't. After all, you didn't see anything."
"I was there."
"It'd just be hearsay testimony. Absolutely that. It would never stand up."
"I don't know," she said. "I don't know about those things, but I know this. I know that isn't the reason you change your mind. What made you change your mind?"
"You never have been on a witness stand. You don't know what it is to have a mean, smart lawyer saw at you while you sweat."
"I'll do it," she said.
"No,
I don't mind."
"Listen here," I said, and shut my eyes and took the plunge off the end of the open drawbridge. "If you think Coffey's lawyer wouldn't have plenty on the ball, you're as crazy as Adam. He'd be mean, and he'd be smart, and he would not have one damn bit of fine old Southern chivalry."
"You mean,"
she began, and I knew from her face that she'd caught the point. "Exactly," I said. "Nobody may know anything now, but when the fun started, they'd know everything."
"I don't care,"
she affirmed, and lifted her chin up a couple of notches. I saw the little creases in the flesh of her neck, just the tiniest little creases, and the little mark left day after day by that absolutely infinitesimal gossamer cord of thuggy which time throws around the prettiest neck every day to garrote it. The cord is so gossamer that it breaks every day, but the marks get there finally, and finally one day the gossamer cord doesn't break and is enough. I looked at the marks when Anne lifted her chin and realized that I had never noticed them before and would always notice them again. I suddenly felt awful. Literally sick, as though I'd been socked in the stomach or as though I'd met a hideous betrayal. Then, before I knew it, the way I felt changed into anger, and I lashed out. Yeah, I said. You don't care, but you forget one thing. You forget that Adam will be sitting right there looking at little sister. Her face was white as a sheet. Then she lowered her head a little and was looking at her hands, which were clenched together now around the empty Coca-Cola glass. Her head was low enough so that I could not see her eyes, only the lids coming down over them. My dear, I murmured. Then, as I seized her hands, pressed around the glass, the words wrenched out of me. Oh, Anne, why did you do it? It was the one question I had never meant to ask. For a moment, she didn't answer. Then, without raising her eyes, she said in a low voice, He wasn't like anybody else. Not anybody else I'd ever known. And I love him. I love him, I guess. I guess that's the reason. I sat there and reckoned I had asked for that one. She said, Then you told me about my father. There wasn't any reason why not, then, after you told me. I reckoned I had asked for that one, too. She said, He wants to marry me. Are you going to? Not now. It would hurt him. A divorce would hurt him. Not now. Are you going to? Perhaps. Later. After he goes to the Senate next year. One part of my mind was busy ticketing that away. The Senate next year. That means he won't let old Scoggin go back. Funny he hadn't told me. But the other part of my mind, which was not the nice, cool, steel filing cabinet with alphabetical cards, was boiling like a kettle of pitch. A big bubble heaved up and exploded out of the pitch, and it was my voice saying, Well, I suppose you know what you're up to.
You don't know him, she said, her voice even lower than before. You've known him all these years, and you don't know him at all.
Then she'd lifted her head and was looking straight into my eyes.
I'm not sorry, she said quite distinctly. Not for anything that's happened.
I walked down the street in the hot darkness toward my hotel, under a magnificent throbbing sky, breathing the old gasoline fumes the day had left and the sweet marshy smell of the river at low water which the night brought up into the streets, and thinking, yes, I knew why she'd done it. The answer was in all the years before, and the things in them and not in them. The answer was in me, for I had told her. I only told her the truth, I said savagely to myself, and she can't blame me for the truth. But was there some fatal appropriateness inherent in the very nature of the world and of me that I should be the one to tell her that truth? I had to ask myself that question, too, and I couldn't be sure of the answer. So I walked on down the street, turning that question over and over in my mind without any answer, until the question lost meaning and dropped from my mind as something heavy drops from numb fingers. I would have faced the responsibility and the guilt. I was ready to do that if I could know. But who's going to tell you? So I walked on, and after a while I remembered how she had said I had never known him. And the him was Willie Stark, whom I had known for the many years since Cousin Willie from the country, the boy with the Christmas tie, had walked into the back room of Slade's old place. Sure, I knew him. Like a book, I'd known him a long time. Too long, I thought then, too long to know him. For maybe the time had blinded me, or rather I'd not been aware of the passing of time, and always the round face of Cousin Willie had come between me and the other face, so that I'd never really seen the other face. Except perhaps in those moments when it had leaned forward to the crowds, and the forelock had fallen and the eyes had bulged, and the crowd had roared, and I had felt the surge in me and had felt that I was on the verge of the truth. But always the face of Cousin Willie above the Christmas tie had come again. But it didn't come now. I saw the face, enormous, bigger than a billboard, the forelock shagged down like a mane, the big jaw, the heavy lips laid together like masonry, the eyes burning and bulging powerfully. Funny, I'd never seen it before. Not really. That night I telephoned the boss, told him what had happened and how Anne had told me, and made my suggestion about getting Adam to swear out a warrant for coffee. He said to do it, to do anything that would nail Adam. So I went to the hotel, where I lay on my bed under the electric fan until the desk called me to get up at about 6 o'clock. Then, by 7, I was on Adam's doorstep, with a single cup of Java sloshing about in my insides and a fresh razor cut on my chin and sleep like sand under my eyelids. I worked it. It was a hard little job I'd cut out for me. First, I had to enlist Adam on the side of righteousness by getting him to agree to swear out a warrant for coffee. My method was to assume, of course, that he was aching for the opportunity to nail coffee and to indicate that the boss was cheering on the glorious exploit. Then I had to lead him to the discovery, which had to be all his own, that this would involve Anne as a witness. Then I had to play the half-wit and imply that this had never occurred to me before. The danger was, with a fellow like Adam, that he'd get so set on seeing justice done that he would let Anne testify hell and high water. He almost did that, but I painted a gory picture of the courtroom scene, but not as gory by half as it would have been in truth. Refused to be party to the business, hinted that he was an unnatural brother, and wound up with a vague notion of another way to get coffee for a similar attempt in another quarter, a vague notion of laying myself open for coffee to approach me. I could put out a feeler for him and all that. So Adam dropped the idea of the charge, but retained the implied idea that he and the boss had teamed up to keep things clean for the hospital. Just as we were ready to walk out of the apartment, he stepped to the mantelpiece and picked up the stamped letters waiting there to be mailed. I'd spotted the top envelope already, the one addressed to the boss. So as he turned around with the letters in his hand, I simply lifted that one out of his grasp, said with my best smile, "Hell, you haven't got any use for this in the daylight," and tore it across and put the pieces into my pocket. Then we went out back and got into his car. I rode with him all the way to his office. I would have sat with him all day to keep an eye on him if it had been possible. Anyway, I chatted briskly all the way downtown to keep his mind clear. My chatter was as gay and sprightly as bird song. So the summer moved on, swelling slowly like a great fruit, and everything was as it had been before. I went to my office, I went back to my hotel and sometimes ate a meal and sometimes did not, and lay under the fan and read till late. I saw the same faces, Duffy, the boss, Sadie Burke, all the faces I had known for a long time and saw so often I didn't notice the changes in them. But I didn't see Adam and Anne for a while. And I'd not seen Lucy Stark for a long time. She was living out in the country now. The boss would still go out to see her now and then to keep up appearances and have his picture taken among the white leghorns. Sometimes Tom Stark would stand there with him, and perhaps Lucy, with the white leghorns in the foreground and a wire fence behind. "Governor Willie Stark and family," the caption would read. Yes, those pictures were an asset to the boss. Half the people in the state knew that the boss had been tomcatting around for years, but the pictures of the family and the white leghorns gave the voters a nice warm glow. It made them feel solid, substantial, and virtuous. It made them think of gingerbread and nice cold buttermilk. And if somewhere not too far in the wings there was a flicker of a black lace negligee and a whiff of musky perfume, then, well, you can't blame him a taking hit. They put it up to him. It only meant that the boss was having it both ways, and that seemed a mark of the chosen and superior. It was what the voter did when he shook loose and came up to town to the furniture dealer's convention and gave the bellhop a couple of bucks to get him a girl up to the room. Or, if he wasn't doing it classy, he rode into town with his truckload of hogs and for $2 got the whole works down at a crib. But either way, classy or crib, the voter knew what it meant, and wanted both Mom's gingerbread and the black lace negligee, and didn't hold it against the boss for having both. What he would have held against the boss was a divorce. Anne was right about that. It would have hurt even the boss. That would have been very different and would have robbed the voter of something he valued, the nice warm glow of complacency, the picture that flattered him and his own fat or thin wife standing in front of the hen house. Meanwhile, if the voter knew that the boss had been tomcatting for years and could name the names of half of the ladies involved, he didn't know about Anne Stanton. Sadie had found out, but that was no miracle. But as far as I could detect, nobody else knew, not even Duffy with his wheezing, elephantine wit and leer. Maybe Sugar Boy knew, but he could be depended upon. He knew everything. The boss didn't mind telling anything in front of Sugar Boy, or close to it, anything, that is, that he would tell, which probably left a lot untold at that. Once Congressman Randall was in the boss's library with him, Sugar Boy, and me, pacing up and down the floor, and the boss was giving him play-by-play instructions on how to conduct himself when the Milton Broderick bill was presented to Congress. The instructions were pretty frank, and the congressman kept looking nervously at Sugar Boy. The boss noticed him. "God damn it," the boss said. "You afraid Sugar Boy's finding out something? Well, you're right, he's finding out something. Well, Sugar Boy's found out plenty. He knows more about this state than you do, and I trust him a hell of a lot farther than I'd trust you. You're my pal, ain't you, Sugar Boy?" Sugar Boy's face darkened with the rush of pleasurable, embarrassed blood, and his lips began to work and the spit to fly as he prepared to speak. "Yeah, Sugar's my pal, ain't you, Sugar Boy?" he said, and slapped Sugar Boy on the shoulder, and then swung again toward the congressman while Sugar Boy finally was managing to say, "I'm your pal, and I ain't talking none." Yes, Sugar Boy probably knew, but he was dependable. And Sadie was dependable, too. She'd told me, but that was in the flush of her first fine rage, and I thought of this with a certain grim humor, was, you might say, in the family. She wouldn't tell anybody else. Sadie Burke didn't have any confidant, for she didn't trust anybody. She didn't ask any sympathy, for the world she'd grown up in didn't have any. So she'd keep her mouth shut, and she had plenty of patience. She knew he'd come back. Meanwhile, she could hack him into a rage, or could try to, for it was hard to do, and she herself would get into one, and you'd think that they would be ready to fly at each other in the frenzy they could build up. By that time, too, you wouldn't be able to tell whether it was a frenzy of love or hate that coiled and tangled them together. And after all the years it had been going on, it probably didn't matter which it was. Her eyes would blaze black out of her chalk-white, pocked face, and her wild black hair would seem to lift electrically off her scalp, and her hands would flay out in a gesture of rending and tearing. While the flood of her language poured over him, his head would rock massively but almost imperceptibly from side to side, and his eyes would follow her every motion, at first drowsily, then raptly, until he would heave himself up, the big veins in his temples pumping and his right fist raised. Then the raised fist would crash into the palm of the other hand, and he'd burst out, "God damn it, Sadie!" Or for weeks there wouldn't be any shenanigans. Sadie would treat the boss with an icy decorum, meeting him only and strictly in the course of business, standing quietly before him while he talked. She would stand there before him and study him out of the black eyes in which the blaze was banked now. Well, despite all the shenanigans, Sadie knew how to wait. She'd learned that a long time back. She had had to wait for everything she had ever got out of the world. So the summer went on, and we all lived in it. It was a way to live, and when you've lived one way for a while, you forget that there was ever any other way and that there may be another way again. Even when the change came, it didn't at first seem like a change, but like more of the same, an extension and repetition. It came through Tom Stark. Given the elements, it was perfectly predictable. On one hand, there was the boss, and on the other hand, there was McMurphy. McMurphy didn't have any choice. He had to keep fighting the boss, for the boss wouldn't deal with him. And it looked more like when than if, the boss ever broke McMurphy in the 4th District, Mac was a goner. So he had no choice, and he would use anything he could lay his hands on. What he laid his hands on was a fellow named Marvin Fry, previously unknown to fame. Fry had a daughter named Sybil, also unknown to fame, but not, Mr. Fry said, unknown to Tom Stark. It was simple, not a new turn to the plot, not a new line in the script, an old home remedy, simple, simple and sordid. The outraged father, accompanied by a friend, for witness and protector, no doubt, called on the boss and stated his case. He got out, white in the face and obviously shaken, but he had the strength to walk. He walked across the long stretch of carpet from the boss's door to the corridor, getting inadequate support from the friend whose own legs seemed to have lost some of their stiffening, and went out. Then the buzzer on my desk went wild, the little red light which meant headquarters flashed, and when I switched on the voice box, the boss's voice said, Jack, get the hell in here.
When I got the hell in there, he succinctly outlined the case to me and gave me two assignments. First, get hold of Tom Stark, and second, find all there was about Marvin Fry. It took all day and the efforts of half of the highway patrol to locate Tom Stark, who was, it developed, at a fishing lodge on Biggers Bay with several cronies and some girls and a lot of wet glasses and dry fishing tackle. It was near 6 o'clock before they fetched him in. I was out in the reception room when he came in.
"Hi, Jack," he said. "What's eating on him now?"
And he cocked his head toward the boss's door.
"He'll tell you," I said, and watched him head toward the door, a wonderfully set-up fellow in dirty white duck trousers, sandals, and a pale blue short-sleeved silky sport shirt that stuck to the damp pectoral muscles and almost popped over the brown biceps. His head, with a white gob cap stuck on it, was thrust forward just a little bit and had the slightest roll when he walked, and his arms hung slightly crooked with the elbows a little out. Watching the arms hanging that way, you got the impression that they were like weapons just loosened and riding easy and ready in the scabbards. He didn't knock, but walked straight into the boss's office. I retreated to my own office and waited for the dust to settle. Whatever it was, Tom was not going to stand and take it, not even from the boss. A half hour later, Tom came out, slamming the door so that the heavy gold-framed paintings of the former governors hung around the paneled walls of the big reception room shivered like autumn leaves in a blast. He stalked across the room, not even giving a look in the direction of my open door, and went out. At first he had, the boss told me later, denied everything. Then he had admitted everything, looking the boss in the eye with a what-the-hell's-it-to-you expression. The boss was fit to be tied when I saw him a few minutes after Tom's departure. He had only one small comfort, that, from the legal point of view, Tom had been just one of a platoon of Sybil's friends, according to Tom himself. But aside from the legal point of view, that fact just made the boss matter, Tom's being one of a platoon. It would be convenient in any discussion of the paternity of Sybil's alleged child, but it seemed to hurt the boss's pride. I had found Tom and brought him in as one of my assignments. The second one took a little longer, finding out about Marvin Fry. There wasn't much to find out, it appeared. He was a barber in the only hotel in a fair-sized town, Dubois-ville, over in the 4th District. He was a sporting barber with knife-edged creases in his striped pants, ointment on his thinning hair, hands like inflated white rubber gloves, a racing form in his hip pocket, the shapeless soft nose with the broken veins like tiny purple vines, and breath sweetly flavored with sen-sen and red-eye. He was a widower, living with his two daughters. You don't have to find out much about a fellow like that. You know it all already. Sure, he has an immortal soul, which is individual and precious in God's eye, and he's that unique agglomeration of atomic energy known as Marvin Fry, but you know all about him. You know his jokes, you know the insinuative hee-hee through his nose with which he prefaces them, you know how the gray tongue licks luxuriously over his lips at the conclusion, you know how he fawns and drools over the inert mass with the face covered with steaming towels, which happens to be the local banker, or the local gambling house proprietor, or the local congressman, you know how he kids the hotel chippies and tries to talk them out of something. You know how he gets in debt because of his bad hunches on the horses and bad luck with the dice. You know how he wakes up in the morning and sits on the edge of the bed with his bare feet on the cold floor and a taste like brass on the back of his tongue and experiences his nameless despair. You know that, with the combination of poverty, fear, and vanity, he's perfectly designed to be robbed of his last pride and last shame and be used by McMurphy, or by somebody else. But it happened to be McMurphy. This angle had not appeared in Marvin's first interview. It appeared a few days later. One of McMurphy's boys called on the boss, said McMurphy had heard how a fellow named Fry had a daughter named Sybil who had something on Tom Stark, but McMurphy had always liked football and sure liked the way Tom carried the ball and didn't want to see the boy get mixed up in anything unpleasant. Fry, the fellow said, was not in any frame of mind to be reasonable. He was going to make Tom marry the daughter. The boss's face must have been something to see at that point. But Fry lived over in McMurphy's district, and McMurphy knew him a little, and maybe McMurphy could put some reasonableness into Fry's head. It would cost something, of course, to do it that way, but there wouldn't be any publicity, and Tom would still be a bachelor. What would it cost? Well, some money for Sybil, folding money. But this meant that McMurphy was simply acting out of a deep heart and generous nature. What would it cost? Well, McMurphy was thinking he might run for senator. So that was it. But the boss, as Ann Stanton had told me, was figuring on going to the Senate himself. He had it in the sack. He had the state in a sack, except for McMurphy. McMurphy and Marvin Fry. But still, he wasn't in any mood to dicker with McMurphy. He didn't dicker, but he stalled. There was one reason he could take the chance and stall. If Marvin and McMurphy had had it sewed up absolutely tight and could have ruined the boss, they would have done it without further ado. They wouldn't have bothered to dicker. They had some cards, all right, but it wasn't necessarily a straight flush, and they had to take their gamble, too. They had to wait while the boss did his thinking and hope that he wouldn't think up anything unpleasant in his turn. While the boss did his thinking, I saw Lucy Stark. She wrote me a note and asked me to come to see her. I knew what she wanted. She wanted to talk about Tom. Obviously, she wasn't finding out anything from Tom himself, or at least what she considered to be the truth and the whole truth, and she wasn't talking it over with the boss, for on the matter of Tom, she and the boss had never agreed. So she was going to ask me questions, and I was going to sit and sweat on the red plush upholstery in the parlor of the farmhouse where she was living. But that had to be. Long back, I'd made up my mind that when Lucy Stark asked me to do something, I was going to do it. It was not exactly that I felt I owed Lucy Stark a debt or had to make restitution or do penance. At least, if there was a debt, it was not to Lucy Stark, and if there was restitution to be made, it was not to be made to her. If there was a debt, it was, perhaps, due to me, from me. And if restitution was to be made, it was to be made to me, by me. And as for penance, there had been no crime for which I should do it. My only crime was being a man and living in the world of men, and you don't have to do special penance for that. The crime and the penance, in that case, coincide perfectly. They're identical. If you've ever been down toward the Gulf, you know the kind of house. White frame, but with the glitter long gone. One story, a wide gallery across the front with spindly posts supporting the shed over it. A tin roof with faint streaks of rust showing red in the channel joints. The whole thing set high on brick pillars to make a cool, cobweb-draped cloister underneath, screened on the front side by rank ligustrums and canna beds for hens to congregate and fluff in the dust, and an old shepherd dog to lie and pant in the hot days. It sits pretty well back from the road, in a lawn gone sparse and rusty in the late season, on each side of an anachronistic patch of concrete walk, which dies blankly at the gate where the earth of the highway shoulder shows raw. There are two round flower beds made by laying an old automobile tire on the ground and filling it with wood earth. There are a few zinnias in each, hairy like an animal, brilliant in the dazzling sun. At each end of the house is a live oak, not grand ones. Beyond the house, flanking it on each side, are the chicken houses and barns, unpainted. But the faded white decent house itself, sitting there in the middle of the late summer afternoon, in the absolute quiet of that time of day and year, with the sparse lawn and tidy flower beds and the prideful patch of concrete walk in front, the oaks at each side, is like nothing so much as a respectable middle-aged woman, in a clean gray gingham dress, with white stockings and black kid shoes, the pepper and salt hair coiled on her head, sitting in her rocker with her hands folded across her stomach to take a little ease, now the day's work is done and the men folks are in the field and it's not yet time to think about supper and strain the evening milk. I stepped gingerly up that patch of concrete walk, as though I were treading on dozens of eggs laid by all those white leghorns back in the chicken run. Lucy led me into the parlor, which was just the place I had known it would be, the carved black walnut furniture upholstered in red plush, with a few tassels still left hanging here and there, the Bible and the stereoscope and the neat pile of cards for the stereoscope on the carved black walnut table, a flowered carpet with little rag rugs laid over the places most worn, the big walnut and gilt frames on the wall enclosing the stern, malarial, Calvinistic faces whose eyes fixed you with little sympathy. The windows of the room were closed, and the curtains drawn to give a shadowy, aqueous light in which we sat silently for a minute as though at a funeral. The palm of my hand laid down on the plush, prickled dryling. She sat there as though I hadn't come, not looking at me, but down at a floral figure in the carpet. The abundant dark brown hair, which, when I first met Lucy out at the Stark place, had been massacred off at the neck and marcelled by the beauty operator of Mason City, had long since grown back to its proper length. The auburn luster was still in it, maybe, but I couldn't see it in the dim light of the parlor. I had, however, noticed the few touches of gray when I met her at the door. She sat across from me on the red plush seat of a stiff, carved walnut chair, with her still good ankles crossed in front of her, and her waist, not so little now, still straight, and her bosom full but not shapeless under the blue summer cloth. The soft, soothing contours of her face weren't girlish anymore, as they had been on that first evening back in old man Stark's house, for now there was a hint of weight, of the infinitesimal downward drag in the flesh, the early curse and certain end of those soft, soothing faces which, especially when very young, appeal to all our natural goodness and make us think of the sanctity of motherhood. Yes, that's the kind of face you'd put on the United States Madonna if you were going to paint her. But you aren't. And meanwhile, it's the kind of face they try to put on advertisements of ready-mix cake flour and patented diapers and whole wheat bread. Good, honest, wholesome, trusting, courageous, tender, and with the glow of youth. The glow of youth wasn't on the particular face anymore, but when Lucy Stark lifted her head to speak, I saw that the large, deep brown eyes hadn't changed much. Time and trouble had shaded and deepened them some, but that was all. She said, "It's about Tom." "Yes," I said. She said, "I know something is wrong." I nodded. She said, "Tell me." I inhaled the dry air and the faint, closed parlor odor of furniture polish, which is the odor of decency and care and modest hopes, and squirmed on my seat while the red plush prickled my pressed-down palm like a nettle. She said, "Jack, tell me the truth. I've got to know the truth, Jack. You will tell me the truth. You've always been a good friend. You were a good friend to Willie and me, back yonder, when..." Her voice trailed off. So I told her the truth about Marvin Fry's visit. Her hands twisted in her lap while I spoke and then clenched and lay still. Then she said, "There's just one thing for him to do." "There might be a settlement, you know, But she broke in, "There's just one right thing," she said. I waited. He'll marry her," she said, and held her head up very straight. I squirmed a little, then said, Well, you see, it looks like there might have been some others, other friends of Sybil, others who..." "Oh, God." She breathed so softly I could scarcely tell it was more than a breath she uttered, and I saw the hands clench and unclench on her lap again. "And," I went on, now I was in it, "there's another angle to it, too. There's some politics mixed up, too. You see, McMurphy wants..." "Oh, God," she breathed again and rose abruptly from the chair and pressed her clenched hands together in front of her bosom. "Oh, God, politics," she whispered and took a distracted step or two away from me and said again, "Politics." Then she swung toward me and said, out loud now, "Oh, God, in this, too." "Yes," I nodded, "like most things." She went to one of the windows where she stood with her back to me in the parlor and peered through a crack between the curtains out into the hot, sun-dazzled world outside where everything happened. After a minute, she said, "Go on. Tell me what you were going to tell." So not even looking at her as she peered out the crack into the world, but looking at the empty chair where she had been sitting, I told her about the McMurphy proposition and how things were. My voice stopped. Then there was another minute of silence. Then I heard her voice back over by the window. "It had to be this way, I guess. I have tried to do right, but it had to be this way, I guess. Oh, Jack." I heard the rustle as she turned from the window and swung my head toward her as she said, "Oh, Jack, I tried to do right. I loved my boy and tried to raise